Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle. Welcome, Jamila.
Welcome. Thank you.
You know, we're going to have an interesting conversation today about something a little different. We're going to be talking with Dr. Jack Griffith, Keenan Professor of Microbiology, Immunology, and Biochemistry, and Jill Diaz, Director of Corporate Relations at the North Carolina Museum of Art, about a new exhibit that blurs the line between science and art, the blurring of the lines between medicine and art. But first, we're going to dive right into some research that matters. The very first one, falls from soft furniture and injuries to young children. As someone who's had young children at one time in their life, as myself as well, all parents worry about their child hitting a desk or a table or something, busting open their lip, busting open their head, right?
Rolling off the bed.
Rolling off the bed.
Yes.
Oh, because your bed could be up high
exactly.
And hitting the floor.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember once my child, when he was young, turns out he's 6'3" now, but when he was not 6'3", he was probably about 3'3", jumped from a sofa to another sofa and didn't quite make it. Mm-hmm. And his head hit the sofa, busted open. We spent the next several hours in the emergency room. And this research, actually, that was presented at the American Academy of Pediatrics annual conference is really looking at nationwide about the accidents from children hitting things like sofas and bed. And it's the leading cause of injury for children age 4 years and younger in the United States. Unbelievable.
That is. In fact, they looked at, 2.3 million children younger than five that were treated for sofa and bed related injuries from 2007 to 2016 and showed that 115.2 injuries per 10,000 kids occurred in this age group.
Yeah, it's not a small number. Most of them aren't serious. They do require a lot of times trauma, and they have to go to the emergency room, which is serious by definition because it's expensive as well as painful. But that a lot of them occur in children younger than 12 months age, and they actually have even the soft furniture injuries. So even those aren't, you know, like you said, they could be on top of something and then falling off. I always used to say, you know, when your instinct is that you got to worry that something, you know, that child could fall, that's probably the right instinct.
Right.
And what can we do? Do we have smart furniture? Do we have things that are lower to the ground? You know, watching the kids more closely, you know, all of these things,
mm-hmm.
Right?
I think as healthcare providers, just discussing with the families, just the dangers of leaving our children unattended to benign appearing furniture.
Right, like watching that football game in the other room. Don't
right.
do that. Talk about things that we might want to do rather than not want to do. This is really some of those fascinating research. Matter of fact, I really would like to get a guest on our show talking about some of this, but it's the artificial intelligence in healthcare. And this particular research is specifically about predicting Alzheimer's disease years before a diagnosis. I bet you were reading this going, wow.
Oh,
that's what I was.
I would love to be a part of that study there. I'm thinking, gosh.
Not because you think that you have Alzheimer's disease, but you'd like to know if you're at risk. Maybe I don't have it, and I'm not going to develop in the next 6 years.
That is correct. These researchers used a deep learning algorithm, apparently. I cannot pronounce this word. 18F-fluorodeoxyglucose. What is that? PET imaging, right?
Yeah, fancy term for a fancy study looking at the uptake of glucose into certain areas of the brain that have been associated with other tests in Alzheimer's diagnosis. And they were able to actually test this out on proven Alzheimer's cases. And the machine begins to learn the uptake imaging that shows it. And then they took 50 patients that it had never studied, and they said it was 100% sensitive at detecting Alzheimer's more than 6 years prior to the final diagnosis. That's impressive, even though it's a small number, has to be verified.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know anything in medicine that's 100% sensitive,
And that study is most useful actually when the test is negative. It was interesting enough because that means a negative test is unlikely to be Alzheimer's.
Right.
It's going to be a true negative. It does not mean that if it tested positive that it's going to be Alzheimer's. We'd have to see other test characteristics. But you have someone you're worried, could it be, may it not be, very, very early, and that test came out negative. Once it's available, that actually would be useful.
Exactly. And I think this is a useful tool for us to find better ways to slow or even halt the disease.
Yep. Talking about slowing and halting, we need to put a brake on firework injuries. Yes, firework injuries. I know that we're not in the summer months right now, but we are getting around holidays, and holidays people like to celebrate with fireworks. And this is about how potential warnings on the products, and this is research that they're talking about in our colleagues in Great Britain, thinking about that, could you put warnings on fireworks packaging? I had never thought about that. Interesting idea, looking at warnings on other products like alcohol and tobacco and even increasingly some food labeling.
And apparently they mentioned warnings are there, but in small, fine print. And that the fireworks are packaged in these bold colors that I think make it a very intriguing to open without looking at any warning that would be kind of just to the side in small print.
Yeah, well, we think about actually cigarette warnings in the United States have traditionally been these teeny little warnings down at the corner in very small font. And you have these beautiful packages and designs and everything and the ads that are really attractive. But you go into other countries and you see these warnings are 50% of the package, that you eliminate a lot of the coloring and you have graphic images. And this is the whole thing, graphic images. So right. You might have graphic images of people losing their hands, people having severious burns on their body. Those sorts of things, I think, would cause some people, some adolescents, to think twice. Would it prevent them all? No. Would it prevent some? Probably.
Exactly.
Yeah. What's the harm?
There's no harm in that. And if it can literally prevent someone or stop someone in their tracks, I think, from using these in dangerous ways, then there's no harm.
Yeah, my faith tradition says if you save one life, it's as if you saved the world.
Right.
I think in this particular research, if we can save lives, we can potentially save the world. Let's talk about our next research that matters, our last one, which is about families that are given some antibiotics for a condition, which most of us have always had, and they don't use them all up, which probably applies to lots of us too, giving those antibiotics to their children when they're sick. Now, that doesn't apply to all of us, but it applies to some, if not a lot of people. That's dangerous.
It's dangerous. The antibiotic may not be dosed for the child. It promotes antibiotic resistance, risk of exposing children to dangerous doses, as mentioned. The antibiotic could be expired with harmful breakdown products. What should we do about this?
Well, I do think that there should be guidelines when you go to the pharmacy, when the doctor prescribes, that talks about if for some reason you didn't finish all your antibiotics, maybe you got sick, maybe you were given 2 weeks and you really only needed a week and you got fully better within a week. Maybe you're given antibiotics and then the culture result for the urine or the strep test came back negative, but you already bought the antibiotics. In all these cases, you should be given instructions for what to do. Maybe you should be given a little baggie for where to dispose of them and how to dispose them. Because a lot of people don't know. You don't want to flush them down the toilet and put those antibiotics in our water supplies. You don't want us to put them in the soil. You have to dispose them and inactivate them. Most people don't know how to do that.
And so certainly education around that from both physicians and our pharmacy colleagues, I think, would be helpful.
Yep. We have a total agreement on that. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Jack Griffin, Keenan Professor at the University of North Carolina, and Jill Diaz, Director of Corporate Relations at the North Carolina Museum of Art, about an exhibit that blurs the lines between science and art, moving the boundaries. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golson, Dr. Jamil Battle. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamila, we're talking with Dr. Jack Griffith, Keenan Distinguished Professor of Microbiology, Immunology, and Biochemistry at the University of North Carolina, and Jill Diaz, Director of Corporate Relations at the North Carolina Museum of Art, about a new provocative exhibit that blurs the lines between science and art. Welcome, Dr. Griffith and Ms. Diaz.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we're always interested in the topic, and we're going to dive into this topic in a second, but we're really also interested in the people behind topics. And I wonder if each of you could tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you kind of came to be in this room in some respects as a metaphor for your interest and passion. And maybe we'll start with you, Jill.
About 4 months ago, I started with the North Carolina Museum of Art, but prior to that had been working supporting the arts here in the Triangle for about 10 years now. So it's something that I'm a closet painter, not very good, which is why I have a day job. And it's something that speaks to me. And so being able to support it is really important. And finding that link here in the Triangle, where we have this vibrant cultural arts scene, and at the same time, these amazing academic institutions, watching as these paths kind of cross, has just been something that's really been exciting since I've been
here. And why art for you?
Well, I was never great at science or math. Really, language and the visual arts have been just something that was a bit more of my forte, and something that allowed me to access the rest of the world. And this exhibition in particular has been exciting for me because I had no idea, you know, some of the research that was going on at UNC School of Medicine until these images drew me in, and I've learned a lot since then.
Right.
I think I have always been involved in photography. Initially, photography back home in Alaska, where I grew up. When I was at Occidental College in Los Angeles, my roommate was a photographer by eventual profession. He's a well-known movie producer now, and we did a lot of photography. So when I went to graduate school at Caltech, I happened to discover the electron microscope laboratories, and that had a dark room, which was a big plus in those days. And then I became very excited about the electron microscope as a science tool, and have done that really ever since. But I've carried both hats all the way along. I do a lot of photography for fun, portraits of friends as gifts, a lot of aerial photography with my airplane, and at the same time, photography of macromolecules. So it's really been two faces, both fun.
And you also have had a very distinguished scientific career.
We've done well. And but part of it is probably the fact that I love images. And I have a strong feeling that the best and most interesting and compelling image really can do a lot to convince your colleagues of the importance of the science behind it. The old adage, image is worth 1,000 words, is really true. And sometimes these single image from the electron microscope can drive an entire scientific field forward. And so we're always looking for that kind of image.
And with those images, can you tell us what's in the art and science of innovation, or kind of what drives the exhibits there?
Well, you know, timing and location could not be more perfect for this exhibition. I mean, we are home to Research Triangle Park and these, you know, amazing universities that are doing cutting-edge research. So from a location standpoint, we've got a free museum that, you know, anyone, any day of the week can come in and access. And then timing-wise, just several weeks before we opened this exhibition, we had opened the Beyond George O'Keeffe in Contemporary Art. And it was so relevant to me, I didn't realize it at the time, but once we opened the exhibition last Wednesday, that when you first go into the O'Keeffe exhibition, you're hit with Jimson weed. Mm-hmm. And O'Keeffe often talked about how flowers were so gorgeous and so small that no one ever stopped to appreciate their beauty. And so she painted them in this large scale so that you were forced to recognize how gorgeous they were. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, we're opening this exhibition over something that you could not see with the naked eye, but has this tremendous beauty. And I thought they dovetail so nicely together.
And, you know, Nedeker, tell us the inspiration for really looking at medicine as art. I mean, there's a long history of the interplay, and I'm thinking about the covers of the Journal of the American Medical Association for a long period of time have been art. And the scenes in the history of medicine that were painted scenes that really illustrated something that they're now, this research in this book. You must have had some inkling at some point in time, aha, this isn't just about electro microscope of a neuron of the brain or some other structure. This has some beauty intrinsically beyond that.
Yes, a comment I made at the opening of the exhibit was that scientists 300 or 400 years ago were people who got onto a sailing ship. They were going to a very far off and strange unknown place like North Carolina. And they took a pen and ink and a pad. And the scientists drew pictures of what they saw, the animals, the plants, the birds, and so on. And if you look back, those pictures, many of them are really fabulous art in themselves. And so I think the scientists nowadays are carrying on that tradition. We don't do voyages in ships. Our voyages are made with microscopes. But still, my colleagues and I know, look carefully in these microscopes and are always looking for the most interesting and attractive structures to present to our colleagues and to enjoy ourselves.
And the idea that this might be an exhibit one day, that must have been a pretty bold thought.
That was a fun thought, yes. Our lab has enjoyed for a long time trying to get covers of journals. And we may have close to a record of 40. And so that's always kind of an add-on to publishing a scientific paper. You finish the paper, and then you try to take one of the images from the work and see if you can color it or add illustrations on top of it to compete with the other people in the journal to get the cover.
Nice.
And why do we think it's important, I guess, to share this with the public?
You know, for me, this is so much about accessibility and it's a launching pad for further discussion. I mean, when I walk through the gallery and there's these just 12 gorgeous images, Jax is actually the only black and white in it, but it's just, it looks, to me, it just strikes me as this very intricate sketch. But when you get in there and after you take in the visual component and you get in a little bit deeper and read the wall panels, for me, I was able to go, you know, that's an area of science I didn't even know was taking place at this time. And then I have a 7-year-old, Belle, who's just this amazingly innovative child. But through, you know, my work in the arts, the way that I've been able to meet her halfway and help her continue her interest in science and building and architecture and all of those things that maybe I'm not as strong in has been accessing them through the arts. And we've gone through this.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a great way for me as a parent to be able to just one more way for me to use the museum to talk about, you know, things that are a little more complex or out of my comfort zone. Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to take a short break, but it does, you know, bring into play all kinds of interesting questions about the role of art and medicine. And I remember when I was a medical student, I was walking around the halls of our micro and the physiology and all these labs, and it was sterile concrete walls. And I was struck by that there was not a single piece of art anywhere, and how depressing that was to me. And I remember going to the dean of the School of Medicine and saying, you know, I really think that we should have some art in here. And he looked at me like I was crazy. Now you would be hard-pressed to find a healthcare institution in the United States that doesn't have a budget for art, that doesn't take serious pride in putting those there, because they recognize it's better for people to be exposed to things that have intrinsic beauty. So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Jack Griffith, University of North Carolina, and Jill Diaz at the North Carolina Museum of Art about a provocative new exhibit about really innovation and blurring the lines between science and art. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jamila Battle. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Jack Griffith, a Keenan professor at the University of North Carolina, and Jill Diaz, director of corporate relations at the North Carolina Museum of Art, about a new exhibit that really looks to understand through advanced medical imaging how science and art come together and perhaps challenge some assumptions. And Jack, I'm wondering if you could help us understand, because I've always thought, you know, we think of increasing a lot of mental illness as really biological, and we can do these fancy imaging, PET scans and MRIs of patients with, let's say, bipolar disorder, and we find that they light up in certain areas of the brain, and we might have a picture of a person, but we might also have this imaging. And does one convey something different, the images that are at the molecular level showing what's happening, though? How do you see that as someone who really delves in this micro world, literally, but also then moves it into a macro world like an art exhibit?
Yes, I think those kind of images are not only compelling, but tell a real story, and particularly for people that may suffer from these issues, it would help them and their family understand that this may not be a matter of just how they were brought up or other issues, but there's some physiological, biological, possibly genetic basis for their illness, and that probably takes a burden off of them. And so these kind of images really can do a great deal, I think, to kind of move people's thinking forward in a very positive way.
And I think it certainly demystifies and takes the stigma away from the brain that, you know, is suffering from mental illness, and we're able to see it really as, I think, a medical impairment or a chronic disease. I know even in my practice with addiction, having an image often there to describe what's going on within the brain on the molecular, physiological level or the basis of that helps to endorse or validate that they actually have a chronic disease.
And if I could add to that, there's a stunning image in this exhibit, which I think Jill and I may feel is our favorite, by Dr. Mismit Kismir at UNC and associated with the Cystic Fibrosis Center. And it's just breathtaking picture that shows the mucus and the mucins in lung cells, and then the lung cells that beat and move the mucus across the lung. And it just tells the whole story about how our lung protects itself against invasion by bacteria and viruses and dirt and debris. And then the backstory of that is what happens when that whole process is damaged and results in cystic fibrosis or a whole variety of lung diseases.
I wonder, Jill, when you see others going through the exhibit, or you're going through it, or your daughter's going through it, and you see images that are difficult. I could imagine in this exhibit or others that there could be difficult images. You might have a loved one with an incurable disease for which there's an image up there, or you might have a loved one with cancer, and we have cancer cells that can be beautiful. There certainly could be art and are art, but they're difficult pictures and they evoke things. Is that surprising, or is that typical when you actually go to museums?
I think it's not only typical for me, it's part of what I want to see. in a museum. I want it to challenge us and to create opportunities to have conversations about things that are difficult topics to normally talk about. And the image that you're talking about, that I had actually a bit of a guttural reaction to it when I first said, what a beautiful image. And then I went on and read a little bit. And then I went back and looked at the image and I thought, how can something that has, you know, caused so much pain be so beautiful? And it really—
Was this the cystic fibrosis one?
This was the cancer.
The cancer
and
one, okay.
It but the cystic fibrosis, I have an interesting relationship with this exhibition, but that is, I think, probably what's drawn me back into the gallery over and over again and watching other people and how they approach it. You can see in a town where we have so many people that are in research, you can watch them come in the East Building and the researchers, they point and then they run right over. The rest of their group is following them. They're fabulous to watch because they immediately start teaching. And then you have those that wander into that section and they have this look on their face, and it isn't until they really dive in and read the wall panels that then they begin to have that discomfort, maybe, or a little bit of the same, you know, these are amazingly beautiful images, but at the same time, the topic and what they're really showing us is uncomfortable and has touched probably all of us in some way.
I think that it reminds me as a learner, even in medical school, and how seeing images really brought life to the detail and the amount of information that we have to know. I was thankful for the pictures.
is there a sense at all that as we move, let's say, to artificial intelligence, I'm just going to jump right through a hole, literally, and the visualization of the soul and the visualization of life and death and the blurring, how do you think 10, 20 years from now, the type of work you do and the ability to continue to get more granular, but at the same time to be able to develop these systems that can reproduce, is there increasing blurring, or is this liable to kind of push us to new places that actually could be both artistic and present dilemmas?
I think we'll see an explosion of beautiful art and science when the last 3 decades of my career mostly was spent in a dark room making prints and then going through the very difficult photographic steps necessary to get something for publication. But over the last decade, the whole new generation of people are not only used to computers, but they're used to Photoshop and Illustrator and all of this computer technology that can be used to make very lovely and interesting and exciting images. And so with the new generation of scientists, I think they will be very comfortable at kind of merging the scientific results with art. And so I think we're just at the very early age of this.
Is it always beautiful? And I'm thinking about, you know, we have violence, plethora of violence and murders and things. And I can imagine someone doing imaging and pictures at a molecular level of things that are happening in war-torn areas and others and bodies and things, but that would be very, very disturbing. I imagine that needs to and will probably occur. Others will take what you're doing and take it to places that you haven't thought about.
Kind of a molecular Gunerka.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a peek into something that's dead and alive at the same time. I mean, I don't know. It makes me think, which I guess that's what art's supposed to do, right?
That's exactly. Yeah.
For those in our listeners who might be interested in seeing these pictures, I think it'd be great if we could put up, they could certainly come, if they're in North Carolina, they certainly could come there. But we have listeners across the country, and I think it'd be great if we could put up a selection of some of these images with some description. Would that be something we could do?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Well, we really want to thank you both for being our guest today. We've been talking with Dr. Jack Griffith, Keenan Professor at the University of North Carolina, and Jill Diaz, Director of Corporate Relations, North Carolina Museum of Art, about their exhibit on science and art. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Yeah,
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice to have us.
Oh. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Wilson, Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Jamila, if a listener has a question they'd like us to ask on an upcoming show, they could just send a comment to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today. Laura?
Our first listener asks, is having a stroke genetic? If my mother had one, am I more likely to have one?
Well, that's a good question. What do you think?
Well, we do certainly have genetic predispositions, but there are modifiable risk factors such as high blood pressure, physical inactivity, smoking.
Exposure to secondhand smoke even.
That's right.
We don't think about. And alcohol use, all things that are... probably diabetes, too.
Atrial fibrillation.
High cholesterol.
Yep.
So one could have lots of those risk factors, and I bet many of them are modifiable. You can lower your blood pressure, you can quit smoking, you can lower your cholesterol, you can lose weight, you can get physically active, you can drink very little alcohol, right?
Yeah, the not-so-fun things.
Well, for a lot of people, those are easier said than done, so people do need help in those elements. So I agree with you fully. Genetics, yes, but risk factor modification, yes, yes.
Yes and yes. And get your doctor to help you.
Yeah. Great question. Good luck. Thank you. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I recently went to see my primary care doctor to talk about severe anxiety and depression. I even had thoughts of suicide. The doctor not only sat and listened, but at the end told me that she could help me get better and promised she would help me get better. I got a prescription for several medications and got set up with a therapist. I came back after starting the prescriptions, and even though I have a few more weeks before my first therapy session, I feel better than I have in years. I just wanted to say thank you to my doctor for restoring my faith in myself and medicine's ability to help me.
That touches my heart.
It makes you happy to be a family doctor, doesn't it?
It does. And also that family doctor did some things right there. What are the things that family doctor did right there?
I think oftentimes when it comes to mental health, we're often stretched because there's lack of resources with mental health. And so we bridge those gaps. So that was right.
Yeah. I think listening, a really good listening and validating that those are real problems, coming up with a plan. There was some medications that were started. Mm-hmm. Seems simple in retrospect, but they probably got the right medications for the right reasons, and that had a response, right? I also like the fact that there was a promise of hope in there and almost even extending it. Like, not only can you get better, you will get better. That's a little bold, but I like it. That doctor was confident. Like, a lot of times we'll give antibiotics and tell patients, you know, you'll get better. We don't often say you may get better.
Exactly.
We say, you know, I think you'll get better. I think that's fine. If you think someone's going to get better, it's okay to say that, right?
That's exactly right. This is medicine, and it's not an exact science, but the treatment for a mental health disorder has a large basis in medication.
Yeah.
And so...
yeah. So, it makes us glad to see that a faith has been restored. And I think a lot of times when patients come into their doctors, there is sometimes some broken trust, maybe in the healthcare system, maybe in the insurance system, maybe in the pharmacy system, lots of different reasons why patients may be distrustful and that faith has to be restored. And I think if you're a patient out there, this also is an opportunity to hear from another patient about getting what they need and to help you get what you may need. Find that doctor that listens and that's willing to work with you and give you some hope.
Hope it is. I love it. And I think it's inspiring and it's the reason why I'm in the field.
Yeah, great. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm getting older and starting to think about knee surgery, especially since I notice I'm sometimes falling. Even though I do regular exercises to strengthen my knees, my doctor suggested that I see a physical therapist so that I could work on balance issues. How frequently are falls related to balance issues rather than poor strength? Is this worth my time?
You know, what a great question. Mm-hmm. You know, increasingly recognize that physical activity has really got different components. There's that, you know, aerobic component. We get our heart rates up, and, you know, that's in endurance. We know there's strength training. And so we know that that also helps really build up and has health benefits. We know that there's flexibility mm-hmm. to prevent the injuries, and then there's balance. And that's the one that I think so few people work on, because when you trip, maybe if you're strong enough, you don't fall. Maybe if you are physically fit, you don't fall. But certainly if you've been working on balance, you may not fall. And that may be the difference between a fall that breaks your hip and a fall that doesn't.
That's true. And in fact, the new, I think, guidelines with activity recommend aerobic, but also stretching and endurance and balance training, because it's all integrative.
And it wouldn't be intuitive for a lot of people to know how to work on balance. It's not just standing on one leg. But there's a lot of different balance things one can do to make certain that, for instance, if your eyes are closed and you can still stay balanced, like what it's like when you walk outside in the dark and maybe trip on a rock. And not only are you disoriented because of the darkness and the high-risk thing. So great idea. Really like to see that that your doctor's recommending that. Laura, what's the very last house call?
I recently went to see my family doctor to have a lesion taken off my lip. I had to travel for over an hour to get there, but when I did, he not only said that he couldn't take it off for me, but that no one in his practice could take it off for me because it required specialized care from a dermatologist. I found this to be a waste of my time. Why couldn't they just have told me that over the phone before I drove an hour?
Well, we have an unhappy patient here, and I do get it. It's frustrating. And I bet it's frustrating for the doctor, too. They probably weren't real happy they couldn't meet your need. And I can imagine when you told me you drove for an hour, and perhaps you called up and spoke to the nurse beforehand, and they said, yeah, come on in. We can take care of that. But yeah, when the doctor saw it, it's like, nope, this is beyond my clinical scope of practice.
Right. So I definitely can feel for this patient. I would definitely, I would want to be taken care of after an hour drive. But you also want to make sure you see someone who is honest about what they can do and be treated by those that are in the scope of their practice.
Right. Lips can bleed. They can get infected. You can get scarring. It can look really bad. And unless you have a doctor that's used to doing surgery on lips, which most family doctors probably are not, some might be, it's not to your best interest. So knowing a doctor that's saying, no, this is outside my scope of practice, but are they willing to help you get in and be seen quickly? Are they willing to apologize? Maybe they're not charging you for that visit that day, hopefully. So, yeah, I think we understand your frustration, but we also applaud the doctor for setting that limit. Maybe some communication. Maybe when we have pictures, you could have sent that picture, and I bet the doctor could have said, nope, not going to do that one. So, it reminds me once I had a patient that didn't like going to see the transplant surgeon, Jamil, and they wanted to know if I could take over their transplant care. I was like, I am really not doing transplant medicine. I can monitor your lab work here. You can get your blood work done here. But I'm not making the decisions on which transplant medicines we're going up and down with, beyond my scope. Well, that'll conclude your health today. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. You can share and ask any question by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guests today, Dr. Jack Griffith and Jill Diaz. And I want to really thank a great co-host and good friend, Jamil Battle, for being with us today. On behalf of your health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.